Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Traynor, the Dean of Georgetown Law, and it's a privilege to welcome you to our 12th Annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference. Georgetown is proud to organize this annual event together with the Migration Policy Institute and Catholic Legal Immigration Network to bring to our campus key officials, advocates, and academics to address the challenging issues associated with immigration in the United States. You'll hear today from these experts about the major trends and problems affecting the U.S. immigration system. And we at Georgetown want to encourage open discussions on what have become very divisive issues around the country. And we're particularly delighted that both Secretary of Homeland Security Johnson and UN High Commissioner for Refugees Guterres, who's the former Prime Minister of Portugal, will deliver keynote addresses today. And as you may know, Georgetown attracts many students interested in learning about and working in this field. And many of our students work with your agencies and organizations during the academic year, the summer, and after graduation. And our faculty teach courses on immigration, refugees, and a host of humanitarian and human rights issues. Our asylum law clinic provides students opportunities to represent asylum seekers in immigration removal proceedings. And our scholars are engaged in research aimed at improving the way in which our country deals with the benefits and challenges of immigration. So I'm pleased to welcome today all our government colleagues, practitioners, advocates, scholars, and students. I have to say, I was looking at the program. It's an extraordinary program, and it's a very full day. And I wish you the greatest success, and I'm just delighted to be able to host this important discussion at our law school. And now let me call to the podium Jean Atkinson, who's the Executive Director of Clinic. Jean?
Good morning and welcome to the 12th Annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference. This conference is co-convened by my organization, Clinic, Migration Policy Institute, and of course, Georgetown University Law Center. Special thanks to you, Dean Traynor, and to Georgetown University Law Center for providing this forum. This year's Immigration Law and Policy Conference comes at an interesting time in our nation. With immigration politics a headline in the 2016 presidential campaign, with a court case that will affect the viability of the president's executive action on administrative relief pending before the Fifth Circuit, and with continued migration of unaccompanied minors and families from Central America, we are at a crossroads. Today's conference will provide nuance and insight into these issues while adding to the national debate on immigration, no doubt. It is my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, the Honorable Jay Johnson, the United States Secretary of Homeland Security, who will start off the discussion with us this morning. Since December 2013, Secretary Johnson has overseen efforts to counter terrorism and enhance security and secure and manage our borders. All this while facilitating trade and travel, enforcing and administering our immigration laws, safeguarding and securing cyberspace, building resilience to disasters, and providing essential support for national and economic security in coordination with federal, state, local, international, and private sector partners. No small order. During his busy tenure, he has overseen the 2014 child and family migration influx and the initial implementation of President Obama's executive action on administrative relief. Prior to joining DHS, Secretary Johnson served as general counsel for the Department of Defense, where he was part of the senior management team and led more than 10,000 military and civilian lawyers across the department. As general counsel of the Defense Department, Secretary Johnson oversaw the development of the legal aspects of many of our nation's counterterrorism policies, spearheaded reforms to the military commission system at Guantanamo Bay, and co-authored the 250-page report that paved the way for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 2010. In addition to the Secretary's illustrious professional career, he is an admitted fan of the TV show Homeland, which he revealed in his sit-down with Claire Danes recently in the New York Times, so a good choice on that. With that last fact, I give you Secretary Jay Johnson. Secretary, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. I'm curious, how many of you in the room here are either lawyers or law students? Please raise your hand. A lot. I'm impressed that the law students are here at 9:05, and the lawyers are here at 9:05. How many of you here work for some component of DHS? Please raise your hand. Many of you. See, I stack the deck. Okay. I was very pleased to receive this invitation to come speak to this conference. I want to thank the Migration Policy Institute, Clinic, and the Georgetown Law School for hosting us here. I welcome the opportunity to discuss with you where we are in our executive actions that the President announced last November. I want to begin by, first of all, thanking the Migration Policy Institute in particular for being such a reasoned voice in the immigration debate. We need more of that. Immigration is an emotional issue filled, frankly, with a lot of misinformation. I gave a speech a couple of months ago at Westminster College in Missouri. It's part of the Green Foundation Lecture at Westminster College. The most famous Green Foundation lecture at Westminster College was given in 1946 by Winston Churchill, a famous Iron Curtain speech at Westminster. In 1954, the former President Harry Truman gave a Green Foundation lecture in which he talked about what hysteria does to us. That was the title of his speech. I decided in the 56th Green Lecture this year to elaborate on those comments and to give sort of a modern day version of President Truman's comments. I said at Westminster, all of us in public office, those who aspire to public office and who command a microphone, owe the public calm, responsible dialogue and decision making, not overheated, oversimplistic rhetoric and proposals of superficial appeal. In a democracy, the former leads to smart and sustainable policy. The latter can lead to fear, hate, suspicion, prejudice, and government overreach. This is especially true in matters of homeland security, and it is especially true in matters of immigration policy. When I talk to public audiences, I like to cite a poll that was done 2 years ago by Pew Research, in which Pew Research asked the following question in 2013. Quote, just your best guess, compared with 10 years ago, do you think the number of immigrants entering the U.S. illegally today is higher, lower, or about the same? 55% of respondents believed then that the numbers of immigrants entering the U.S. illegally then, in 2013, was higher than it was 10 years before, when in fact, the opposite is true. In the year 2000, as many of you know, there were 1.6 million apprehensions on our southern border. Apprehensions are an indicator of total attempts to cross the border illegally. 1.6 million in FY 2000. That number has gone down significantly in recent years, over the last 15 years. In FY 13, the number was 414,000. In FY 14, the number was 479,000. The increase owing principally to the spike in the kids and families on the southwest border in the Rio Grande Valley. And then in FY 15, the number was 331,000, which, with the exception of 1 year, was the lowest number of apprehensions we've seen since 1972. This decline is due to a number of things. I believe it is due, in part, at least, to the investment we've made in this country to border security. The numbers over the last 3 months of fiscal year 15 are starting to rise again, particularly in the Rio Grande Valley, particularly among families and unaccompanied children. Again, they're not like we saw in FY14, but they are very clearly rising again. But overall in 15, the number was just 331,000. There is more we can do when it comes to border security. As a sovereign nation, we must protect our borders from illegal immigration consistent with law. But building a wall across the entire Southwest border is not the answer. Pursuant to the Secure Fence Act of 2006, we did in fact build walls. We built a lot more wall to the point where today we have something like 700 miles of wall across our Southwest border in places where it makes sense to build a wall. The Southwest border, as a lot of people here know, consists of the Rio Grande, desert, and mountains. And so the thought of building a wall, I think the best response to that I heard from a border security expert who said, do you really think that someone motivated enough to leave Central America, travel the entire length of Mexico heading north, and climb a 10,000-foot mountain is going to be deterred by a 10-foot wall once they get there? Or, as Janet Napolitano used to say, build a 10-foot wall and I'll show you an 11-foot ladder, or perhaps even a tunnel. So building more walls is not the answer. What border security experts say, and I agree with this, is a risk-based strategy to our border security that involves more technology, more surveillance, and a smart and effective way to patrol our borders. We established last year in-country processing in Central America, an alternative that provides a lawful and safe path for children in Central America looking for a better life in America. I'm disappointed that the program has not been more productive. I do believe that with our border security efforts, we can do a lot to contain and manage a problem, but the push factors in Central America continue to exist. The poverty and violence in Central America continues to exist, which is why the Obama administration wants to invest $1 billion in aid to Central America to address the underlying problems. I believe we need to expand upon this, and we need to make the hard investment to address the push factors in Central America. Today, I want to review with you the status of our executive actions announced last November. It is disappointing that Congress has not acted on comprehensive immigration reform. It is disappointing that the Senate passed a good comprehensive immigration reform bill in 2013 by a significant bipartisan margin, but that the House has not done the same thing to fix our broken immigration system. Given that, the President and I announced last year that we were acting within our existing legal authority to do as much as we could to try to fix our broken immigration system in a number of different respects. Overall, the President's policy when it comes to the prioritization of our resources is a smart, common sense use of resources to go after threats to public safety, felons, not families, quality of our efforts over quantity, giving people an opportunity to come forward out of the shadows and be accountable, and to promote border security. I'm disappointed that our Deferred Action for Adults program is the subject of a lawsuit and is pending now in the Fifth Circuit. More on that later. As all of you know, the program has been enjoined by the district court and is on appeal. The case was argued in the Fifth Circuit on July 10th, and we are still waiting for a decision. We intend to fight the case on appeal and defend the program. Meanwhile, we're moving forward on the other 9 out of 10 executive actions that we announced last November, and I intend to give you a status report on that. First and foremost is our reprioritization of our resources for removal, who we are focusing on when it comes to removal. In general, what we announced last November is a new policy that is clearer in promoting the removal of felons, convicted criminals, over families, over those who have been here for years and committed no serious crimes, and quality of our efforts over quantity and public safety. I note what the Migration Policy Institute said about our new prioritization policy just a few months ago. Quote, "These prosecutorial discretion changes, which have received significantly less public attention than the DAPA program, make it unlikely that unauthorized immigrants who would qualify for DACA or DAPA will be deported. The overall impact of the new memorandum is to describe DHS enforcement priorities more precisely and more narrowly than was the case under the 2010 and 2011 guidance, while broadening the circumstances under which DHS personnel should exercise discretion, including reasons departmental personnel may choose not to deport people who generally fall within the enforcement priorities. Overall, the new enforcement policies have the potential to substantially transform the U.S. deportation system, particularly within the U.S. interior," end quote. So we are focusing our resources on convicted criminals, on threats to public safety. In FY12, as many of you know, ICE removed 409,000 individuals from within the interior. In FY13, that number went down to 368,000. FY14, 315,000. Though we are still determining the number for FY15, the year that just finished, we expect that the removals by ICE in fiscal year 15 will be significantly lower than 315,000, which was the 14 number. There are several reasons for this decline in deportations, intended and other reasons. First, the first reason is Immigration Customs Enforcement is doing what I told them to do, to reprioritize and focus on convicted criminals. So we know that of those deported by ICE in the period March through September of this last year, 83% of those deported were in my priority one for deportation. In other words, convicted felons, criminal gang members, and those apprehended at the border. At-large arrest of those convicted of felonies and misdemeanors is up 22% from last year. So deportation numbers are going down, but the percentage of those who are deported increasingly are the convicted criminals, the felons, and the like. This past fiscal year, 89% of those arrested by ICE's fugitive operations team were convicted criminals, the highest percentage in that program's history. This is the general direction that the President and I want to go when it comes to how we enforce immigration law, focusing on threats to public safety and border security for the American public. There are other reasons for the lower deportation levels. First of all, quite simply, as I noted earlier, there have been fewer crossings on the border, on the southwest border, so less intake, so to speak. Another reason, frankly, has been the lack of cooperation between state and local law enforcement and our federal immigration enforcement personnel. The Secure Communities Program, as all of you know, had become hugely legally and politically controversial. Part of our executive actions was to end the Secure Communities Program. In the period January 2014 to June 30, 2015, something like 16,000 detainers issued by ICE were not acted upon by state and local law enforcement. That is something that we needed to change and to do so in a smart, common sense way. So we ended the Secure Communities program and replaced it with our priority enforcement program. We've ended, with some exceptions, detainers, and we are now only seeking the transfer of those in local detention who have been convicted of certain crimes and who constitute priorities for removal. As the Migration Policy Institute noted, PEP preserves a powerful tool for law enforcement. So far, in our efforts to introduce the program to state and local law enforcement, we have received a good and positive reception. Of the approximately 340 non-cooperating jurisdictions that were previously not cooperating with the Secure Communities program, nearly two-thirds are now working with us again with the priority enforcement program. Of the 25 largest jurisdictions, which account for 83% of previously declined detainers, 15 of those 25 are now working with us again, including in California, the counties of Alameda, Fresno, San Diego, San Mateo, Riverside, and Los Angeles County. More will be coming online soon, including some major cities. And preliminary indications are the individuals being transferred pursuant to this priority enforcement program are, for the most part, within my priority one for removal. Again, the felons, the criminal gang members. We are doing this, and we must do this for public safety. I do not believe that no cooperation at all is a responsible option. With respect to the other executive actions that we announced last November, first, we have issued a proposed rule to expand eligibility for provisional extreme hardship waivers of the 3 and 10 year ban to all persons who statutorily qualify for that waiver. We've extended the waiver to the full extent of our statutory authority. The comment period for this proposed rule is closed, and we're now reviewing the 600 comments we received and are preparing to issue the final rule. Second, and to encourage broader use of this waiver, on October 7th, we published new guidance for public comment on the extreme hardship requirement in the statute. Up until now, no clear guidance on what extreme hardship means had been out there. For decades, there had been confusion and inconsistent application of the extreme hardship waiver. The new guidance provides needed clarity. The comment period for this is open until November 23rd, and we encourage you to send us your comments and help publicize this guidance once it's final. Third, on September 25th, State and DHS made changes to the visa bulletin to enable certain families to apply for green cards sooner. Fourth, we have almost completed guidance to assist families of those defending our country in the U.S. military to permit them to obtain work permits. On October 15th, we provided public notice of a proposed rule to strengthen the program that provides optional practical training for students in STEM fields studying at U.S. universities. On May 26th, we finalized a new rule that allows spouses of highly skilled H-1B workers to apply for a work authorization or an H-4 visa. We're promoting and increasing access to U.S. citizenship. The week of September 14 to 21, we launched Citizenship Week and Constitution Day, and USCIS naturalized 40,000 people in that 1 week. And we now permit credit cards to pay for naturalization fees. We continue to assess a partial fee waiver, an idea that I know has been championed by Clinic and other organizations. In terms of our deferred action program for adults, as everybody here knows, the program is enjoined. And the appeal was argued July 10th. We are waiting for the Fifth Circuit ruling on this. As I said earlier, we continue to defend the litigation and defend the program. to those of us who say we don't have the authority to do this program without a change in law, I say, then we should change the law. We must account for these people and encourage them to be accountable. There are an estimated over 11 million undocumented people in this country who are not going away. We are not going to deport a population of people the size of New York City and Chicago put together. They live among us. To me, the most striking statistic about this undocumented population is that more than half of them have been here more than 10 years. That's the estimate. We must account for these people. We must reckon with this population. They are not going away in a Democratic or Republican administration. We want to encourage them to come forward, submit to a background check, and if eligible, get on the books. This is simply the right thing to do for a number of reasons, for law enforcement reasons, and because a number of us believe there should be no second-class people in this country. So we continue to fight to defend that program. And again, for those of us, to those of us who say we do not have the authority to do this without a change in law, then I say it's time to change the law. In general, I like to tell audiences that Homeland Security is a balance between basic physical security and preserving our American values and striking that balance. We can erect more walls and install more screening devices and make everybody suspicious of each other, but we should not do so at the cost of who we are as a great nation of people who cherish our privacy, our religions, our freedom to speak, travel, and associate, and who celebrate our diversity and our immigrant heritage. In the final analysis, these are the things that constitute our greatest strength as a country. Thanks for listening to me, and I'm happy to take questions. Okay, who has a question? There are a lot of lawyers and law students here. I know you're not shy. And a few journalists sprinkled in. So who has a question? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you so much, Mr. Secretary. Detention Watch Network and the National Immigrant Justice Center recently released a report criticizing the inspections process used by ICE to inspect detention facilities. Specifically, it found that they're not truly independent, that they aren't often announced ahead of time, that it uses a checklist culture, and perhaps most concerningly, that there's no real consequences for facilities that violate standards. I was wondering if you could respond to critiques of the inspection process generally and any commitments you can make to improve it before the end of this administration.
Well, first of all, I personally have visited a number of our immigration detention centers to inspect them myself. In May, we appointed an outside advisory panel to evaluate our detention centers as well. And this is something that I am very focused on, that a number of people at DHS headquarters is focused on. It receives a lot of congressional scrutiny, as you probably know. So are there things that could be improved in our immigration detention facilities? Yes. We continue to want to improve access to counsel, for example, basic conditions. And it's a top priority of mine. It's a focus of mine. And I want to get this advisory panel up and working, which consists of a broad array of people, and hear what they have to say as well. But, you know, people like Esther Oliveria sitting over there, who works for DHS, visits these places as well. And it's something I want to get right. Thanks.
Do you identify yourself and your organization when you ask your question?
Yes, sir, right here.
Yeah, my name is Jim Simpson. I'm an independent journalist.
Why don't you speak into the microphone there?
Sure.
My name is Jim Simpson. I'm an independent journalist. I was curious, and I'd like to know, you have expressed concern about the ability to identify Syrian refugees, and the Director of National Intelligence has called it a huge concern. The FBI director says these people can't be vetted, yet on the other side of the track you have the refugee agencies saying that it's no big problem, and in fact, they're speeding up the process by which they vet Syrians. It seems like the administration is talking out of two sides of its mouth. Not unusual, but I'd like to hear what how you reconcile that.
Well, like a lot of things, the answer is a little more nuanced than that. What I've said, and I believe this is perfectly consistent with what Jim has said, is that we have in place a system for vetting refugees, and it's an improved system. It's improved from the place where it was when we admitted large numbers of Iraqi refugees a few years ago. We now do a better job of consulting a variety of different data sources, but there's an inherent limitation in that if there's not a lot for which you can consult with respect to the person who's right in front of you. And what the FBI director and I have said is that when we look at a lot of Syrian refugees, very often it's going to be the case that we're just not going to know a whole lot about the person in front of you. We're not going to get a lot of host nation cooperation and participation in that effort. So that is going to be a challenge, very definitely. The system, however, in place is a better system than we used to be. And in general, I believe that we have to do a careful job, do the best we can. I do not want to compromise security for the purpose of meeting our commitment. I believe we should admit 10,000 Syrian refugees. I think we have to do our part to address a humanitarian crisis in addition to the humanitarian aid we are providing. So I believe we should admit Syrian refugees in greater numbers, but I'm committed to doing so carefully.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Go ahead.
The problem I see is that, in spite of what you just said, and Richard claims that they are going to speed up the process, don't you think, if anything, the process should be slowed down? And in terms of resettling Syrians here, you get a bang for the buck that's about 50-1 by helping them in place. And it's better for them for their future because they can move back to their homes once the conflict is over, rather than bringing here when the cost is astronomically higher per person than it is. In addition to that, and that's something that everybody agreed on when the Kosovar Albanians were resettled here, and they were only resettled here because the voluntary agencies prevailed on President Clinton against the wishes of everybody else involved. Finally, on the 10,000 Syrians, will their families then not be allowed to come as well, increasing that to maybe 40 or 50,000? Thank you.
Well, there are a couple things in that question. First, the UNHCR has in their pipeline, in effect, a large number of refugees, some of which will be referred to the U.S. for evaluation, some of which will be referred to a lot of other countries. They're already in that pipeline. We're going to commit the resources to meeting our commitment for this fiscal year. But there is a process in place that has to take place for evaluating each individual refugee applicant to the country. There's a process that I know UNHCR goes through in deciding whether this person is more appropriate for referral to the U.S. or some other part of the world. But there's a process, and I do not believe we should compromise the security aspect of the process, and we're going to meet our commitment. In my experience, in my observation, when you talk about resettlement, there is a Syrian American, or number of Syrian American communities here that are pretty embracing when it comes to newly settled refugees. I've personally met Syrian refugees who've recently arrived in the country who are living among and within Syrian American communities that are pretty embracing. And so I think that one advantage that we have here is that the Syrian American community in particular is a fairly welcome and embracing and cohesive community in my observation. And I think that's a good thing. Okay. I see a question right here. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Secretary, you probably have time for two more questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Secretary Amanda Berkson-Chilcock from National Skills Coalition. We've talked a lot about enforcement this morning. My question is actually about integration. Mm-hmm. USCIS has self-funded a set of citizenship and integration grants, and those have been very influential in local communities. I'm wondering if there's more that the department could do in its budget request to Congress or with the allocation of discretionary funding to support those kinds of integration activities.
Well, there's always more we could do, but we've got to work with the resources we have. And as you know, USCIS is a fee-based organization with everything except with respect to E-Verify. So it's got to pay for itself. And because of the world situation that the gentleman over here highlights, we do have a lot of challenges and we do have a lot of different directions to go. We've got the Syrian refugee crisis. We have something like 1,000 people a day crossing our southwest border, many of whom apply for asylum, seek asylum, assert credible fear. I'm always interested in expanding good programs. I've got to work with what Congress gives us. And so I'm very pleased that the House has passed a budget deal that the President supports and that the congressional leadership supports. I hope we get some relief. We definitely need relief from sequestration. If we had to live with a sequestered budget, I'd have to seriously cut back on a lot of this good work. It looks like we'll get some relief, but we still have to live within limits. I got time for one more question. This gentleman right here, yes, sir.
Aloha, Secretary Johnson. I was wondering, now that the DAPA is under appeal in the Fifth Circuit and you're still waiting to hear, my question is, in the event that the Fifth Circuit takes its time and the administration doesn't have enough time to act and implement, you know, the executive action, is there any contingency so that we can help the parents of these children, so that they can, you know, be able to apply for whatever ways that we can allow them to stay with their children?
Good question. And the best I can tell you here is that we're taking it one step at a time. We're waiting for that Fifth Circuit ruling to come out. And we're going to take it one step at a time. I remain of the firm belief that offering deferred action to adults who have been in this country 5 years and who have kids who are citizens or lawful permanent residents is something that we should do. But we will take it one step at a time once we see what the Fifth Circuit is going to do. Okay, I got to go. I know you have a full day after me. I'm sorry I couldn't call on everybody, including one or two neighbors I see. You have a terrific program ahead of you. Again, I want to thank Clinic and MPI and Georgetown Law School for doing this. I believe that an informed and interested public, particularly the people in this room, is a good thing, and it's a good environment in which to create policy. So thank you very, very much for your interest, and have a good conference. Thanks.
Thank you so much.